You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up after yesterday's snowstorm, people in northern Wisconsin may be wondering if they should shovel the leaves or rake the snow. We'll look at who got how much and what kind of winter we may be in for. First, the campaign websites for both President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden encourage supporters to be poll watchers on Election Day. So right now we're taking a look at what the law is in Wisconsin and how the practice works around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a poll watcher? What got you involved? What was the experience like? What do you think people should know about the practice? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Reed Magny is the Public Information Officer for the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Reed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
What does it take to be a poll watcher in Wisconsin?
Anybody can be a poll watcher, and poll watchers are welcome. Basically, find a polling place you are interested in observing at and show up on Election Day. Nobody has to send you. Nobody has to train you. Nobody has to appoint you. But once you're there, you need to follow the directions that you get from the chief inspector. The chief inspector at that polling place is in charge, and, you know, show up, find the chief inspector. They'll ask you for an ID. They'll ask you to sign in, and they'll tell you where to sit. And so you go there and you sit and you observe. You know, it's different than some other states where you have to be, you know, you have to get training or you have to be appointed by someone.
Can you lay out some of the do's and don'ts for me if I'm a poll watcher?
Sure. So the biggest do is don't cause a disturbance. If you cause a disturbance, you're going to be asked to leave, or at least warned to, you know, to cut it out. And if you don't, you'll be asked to leave. And if you don't leave, law enforcement will come. That said, you know, you can certainly be using your cell phone, but don't be talking on it. Do not take pictures or video of voters coming in. You know, do not be interacting with voters. You're not there to talk to them, but that's the poll worker's job. Don't be telling poll workers how to do their jobs. Don't be in their business. If you see something that you think isn't right, go and talk to the chief inspector. Tell the chief inspector about it, and they will deal with it.
And what kind of things would a poll watcher typically raise as a concern if they're doing it right to that chief inspector?
Well, so, you know, I mean, if, for example, if you do know that here's an example, somebody comes in and they don't ask the person for a photo ID. Don't get up and say, hey, wait a minute, that person has to do it. Go talk to the chief inspector about it, right? So that's, I guess that would be, you know, one example. I mean, if you have specific knowledge that a person who comes to vote is not qualified because they're not a U.S. citizen, because they're not at least 18, or they don't live at the place where they say they live, then you can actually challenge that voter. I will tell you, this challenge process that's allowed in state law almost never happens, but you know, it is possible. And then they'll get the chief inspector. They'll hold almost a little mini hearing there.
Now, election security and safety, those are issues on people's minds. We've seen the Michigan state government put forward a rule saying no firearms within a certain distance of polling location. Can people expect any kind of law enforcement presence in Wisconsin? And what guidance, if any, is the Elections Commission providing to election officials about de-escalation techniques or the possibility of openly carried firearms at the polls?
So at polling places, the rules about firearms are really governed by state law and local ordinances, just like at any school where you might go and see, you might see that there's a sign on the door that says no firearms allowed, or something like that. It's really covered by local ordinances or local building owners. And we're in the process of providing some guidance to our clerks, just some basics about how those laws work, what to do if there are issues. We really encourage clerks to work with their law enforcement to be there. in case there's an issue. Now, that said, there should not be like uniformed police stationed at polling places. That's potentially intimidating to some voters. And so that shouldn't happen. Also, you're not going to see any, people, like National Guard people in uniform or anything like that. That just doesn't happen here. And especially with the National Guard, it can't happen with them being there in uniform. But we do not have the ability to make any rules about firearms or things like that at polling places. The state law doesn't give us that any of that authority.
I know in some states, poll watchers may also watch the counting of ballots. Is that something people can do in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. So the counting of ballots, usually ballots are counted by you mark your ballot, you put it into the machine, and then it sits there. The machine obviously takes note of your, records your votes electronically. Then usually at 8 o'clock when the polls close, assuming that all the absentee ballots have been counted, and we can talk about that in a minute. But at 8 o'clock, what happens then is that there's an actual public meeting, and it's called the Board of Local Canvassers. And anybody can be there. You can, you can watch them as they, switch the machine from or into what's known as reporting mode. And it's going to print out sort of a long cash register type receipt with the official results on it. And they're going to read those results aloud. And you can be there for that. You can be there watching them, doing their what's known as reconciliation, making sure that they have the same number of voters as they do ballots. All of that is observable. Even if you want to take out your cell phone and take a picture of those results that come out of the tape of the machine, you can have that, and then you can go to your county's website later in the evening and see, okay, for Ward 13, it said that this was the totals, and yeah, this matches up. So the correct results got to the correct place.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Reed, you mentioned those absentee ballots or early vote ballots. There are going to be a lot of them this year. How do they get counted?
They get counted the same way as other ballots, usually. So in most places in the state, absentee ballots are counted at the polling place where the voter would have normally voted. There's about 39 cities, villages, and towns, including big ones like Milwaukee and Green Bay, not Madison, by the way, that count their ballots at a central location. And they do it using high-speed scanners and other things like that. Those places are also open, and you can be an observer there, or you can, show up at 8 o'clock. But they can't start counting those ballots until 7 in the morning. And so it could take all day and into the evening to do that, and maybe Reed, the next morning.
Reed, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
Reed Magny is the Public Information Officer for the Wisconsin Elections Commission. He talked with us about Wisconsin's laws around poll watching. Coming up, we'll take a look at the national picture when it comes to poll watching. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done this? Been a poll watcher before? What was that like? What made you decide to take part? Do you have concerns about how it'll work in this election? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about poll watching now. Rebecca Green joins us, professor at William & Mary Law School and co-director of the school's election law program. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we just heard the scene here in Wisconsin, but things are different from one state to another. What kind of stories are you watching around the country when it comes to poll watching?
Yeah, well, I think the important thing, first of all, to stress about poll watching is that it's an incredibly important function in our democracy, right? Partisan mistrust has always been a central feature of American elections, and state transparency regimes address those concerns by ensuring that campaigns and candidates and members of the public can observe elections at all stages. And, from what you just heard from the elections office in Wisconsin, that's certainly the case in Wisconsin, where anyone can go and observe our elections. So around the country, we're seeing I just talked to someone here in Virginia who spent his morning watching the absentee ballot processing. So I think this is particularly this year, people are very engaged and hoping to observe and make sure that things are being done correctly. So I expect to see high volumes even during a pandemic.
There have been concerns in the past, and I know some people have raised them this year, about poll watchers intimidating voters or creating disruptions at polling stations. Is this something we typically see, though?
So I think in the past there have been isolated incidents of things like that happening. But I think it's important to stress that federal and state law imposes criminal penalties for voter intimidation. It's illegal to intimidate, threaten, or coerce a person or attempt to do so for the purpose of interfering with that person's right to vote. If we see an increased incidence of that this year, that doesn't make it any less illegal. Across the country, I think poll workers are being trained on what people can and can't do. And there's going to be a lot of attention to making sure that people follow the rules.
As we heard from Reed Magny with the Wisconsin Elections Division, you can go in on Election Day and sign up to be a poll watcher. That is not necessarily the case in every state, though, right?
No, not at all. So a lot of states have, they require you to be a party appointed or sometimes campaign or candidate appointed observer. So you have to kind of go through an appointment process and you're on a list and you show up if you're not on the list, you can't be a poll watcher. Some states have training where they require people who've been appointed to go through some kind of training so they understand what they can and can't do on election day or whenever they're observing. So it's a varying degree of formality depending on the state that you're in.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Margaret is with us in Middleton. Margaret, hi.
Hi. I am calling as a former candidate poll watcher a number of years ago, and we used to listen for the name and address of individuals because they're required to give their name and address when they, come to get their ballot. And then if at the end of the day, and we would have a list of, folks that had identified as supporters of that candidate. And if that name, hadn't voted by late afternoon, they'd get a call from the candidate, encouraging them to vote, to get out the vote. And I don't know that I have seen that happen in recent years, and I wondered if it was still legal and why candidates aren't doing that
gotcha.
Anymore.
Margaret, thanks a lot for sharing your experience there. I don't know the specifics of Wisconsin law on that, but is that a use sometimes of poll watching to see if you're people you know are your voters have made it in to vote yet?
As she was talking, I was having fond memories. I grew up in New Hampshire, and that we certainly did that in New Hampshire. So I think there are many states where people use the opportunity to figure out whether their voters have gotten to the polls. And so it's certainly something that happens. And I don't know the law in Wisconsin either in terms of whether that's illegal or legal in Wisconsin these days, but it's certainly a practice that lots of campaigns have engaged in over the years.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Noah in Rice Lake. Noah, hello.
Yeah, I'm a poll worker, and the material that we were given about poll watchers, one thing you have to have is you have to have a mask. Otherwise, you could be asked to leave. Thank you.
Interesting. Noah, thanks a lot for sharing that. Rebecca, how are we dealing with the pandemic when it comes to poll watchers having some extra people in these inside spaces?
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. And this year, being an observer in at the polling place is going to be a little bit trickier because of social distancing and the need to wear masks. And I think election officials are going to have to spend a lot of time. I'm sure they've already spent a lot of time planning, how to ensure that there are ways for people to observe, but to do so safely. And so I think you'll see a lot of attention to that issue. And certainly, anyone who signs up to be a poll watcher will have to abide by those rules very strictly. I would think that any infractions will result in you getting kind of booted from the polling place as people are, you know, concerned about safety and voting.
Thanks, Noah, for calling in. Kim joins us now in Eau Claire. Kim, hello.
Hello. Thanks for the program. I was called by a man from New York to ask to be a poll watcher and that there would be some webinar training. And I just was wondering if you've heard of that. I would have thought people from Wisconsin would have been calling people from Wisconsin to get poll watchers to volunteer.
And to be clear, Kim, they wanted you to go to New York and watch a poll, or somebody in New York wanted you to watch a poll here in Wisconsin?
Somebody from New York, he said he was a lawyer, that he volunteered to call people to get them to be poll watchers in Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin, okay. Not asking you to hit the road. Thanks for clarifying that. Now, I know our laws in Wisconsin, you can actually be from another state and be a poll watcher in Wisconsin, and the organizing of those efforts could come from anywhere, I guess, Rebecca.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think this year, you know, everyone's stuck at home and wanting to do something. And so I think you're getting a lot of this, what can I do on the phone? And one of the things you can do is you can help recruit either poll workers or poll watchers in other states. And both are obviously really important functions in our election to make sure that there are enough polling stations open so that everyone who wants to vote can, and also to make sure that there's enough transparency to ensure that the public has confidence in the results. So I think both of those roles are really important, and I'm not surprised to hear that there's people on the phones trying to recruit people for those roles.
Kim, thanks a lot for calling in, and Rebecca, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Rebecca Green is professor of the practice of law and co-director of the election law program at William & Mary Law School. She talked with us today about how poll watching works around the country. We heard earlier from Reed Magny with the state's election division, looking at how poll watching works and what to expect on election day. With less than 1 month to go until Election Day, the country is facing simultaneous crises, a coronavirus pandemic, growing economic hardship, and ongoing racial turmoil. This summer, a huge amount of energy built up for the Black Lives Matter movement around the country and here in Wisconsin. As Bridget Bowden reports, the question is whether that energy will translate into votes.
It's been a while since Kayla Lewis Allen of Madison voted in an election.
I honestly, if I can be completely honest, I have not voted since Barack Obama.
She has a booth set up at an event for Black voters at a Milwaukee brewery. She's here to promote her small business and talk to people about voting. She's excited to cast her ballot this year, she says, because of everything that's been going on.
So we had COVID happen, and then Black Lives Matter was booming because several Black men and Black women being killed. I think that is gonna bring everybody out. I think that was the switch that everybody needed.
She says that learning about George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Jacob Blake and watching the protests made her think that her vote could make a difference. And she thinks there are lots of other people like her.
So I talk about my friends, my husband, my son is 11 years old, and he's like, I wish I could vote. So like everybody's getting this conversation.
Getting people motivated by the protests is one thing. Getting them motivated by the candidates on the ballot is another. Donald Trump has criticized the Black Lives Matter movement and sided with police on issues like use of force. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have supported the movement, but Biden has been criticized for his tough-on-crime record as a senator and Harris for her record as a prosecutor. Just a few tables over, Katie Avila Lockmiller says that some people feel like the election won't necessarily change how the criminal justice system treats Black people. But she says now is not the time to give up on voting.
So I think there's a lot of people who feel exhausted and might not be as energized to go vote. But then I think there's another group of people who are, I guess myself included, are saying, please, this isn't the time to get exhausted. This is the time to continue to organize and strategize.
It's unclear exactly how the general public's views of the Black Lives Matter movement could shape the election. According to the Marquette University Law School poll, support for the movement in Wisconsin surged this spring after the death of George Floyd, before it declined later in the summer. It stayed relatively steady since then, even after the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, the riots that followed, and the visits to Kenosha by both presidential candidates. But poll director Charles Franklin says both the Republican and Democratic Party bases are paying attention.
It's very motivating for the folks that are taking part in the protests or sympathizing with the protests. But folks on the pro-Trump side also see it as an opportunity to mobilize fear of, as they would say, crime and violence in the cities.
And it's not just the voters who are motivated. Campaigns are watching the movement, too. Maya Neal is the political manager at Leaders Igniting Transformation, a Milwaukee group that organizes Black and brown youth to push for social, racial, and economic justice. She says this summer's events have put the issue front and center.
It's really forcing them to address it, because if you ran a campaign and didn't address racial discrimination and didn't address the Black Lives Matter movement that's marching outside of all of our front doors, you're just choosing to be blind at that point.
But even though a big part of her job is getting people out to vote, she says when it comes to advancing the Black Lives Matter movement, voting is only one piece in the puzzle. She says no matter what, there will still be work to be done long after November 3rd. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, winter is coming early for northern Wisconsin. We'll look at what's going on, the possibility of another snowstorm this weekend, and in general, what kind of winter we can expect across the state. By the way, tomorrow night, scheduled debate between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden, hosted by Ari Shapiro, will have some live NPR coverage that's starting tomorrow night at 8. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the president's tweets have become a regular part of politics and the news cycle. We'll zoom out and look at the tweets of the past 4 years that got us here. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum remembering a friend and her love of the Mississippi River.
At WPR, we recently lost a beloved former colleague to cancer. Breanne Shasso was sharp, intelligent, and deeply caring. Her loss has been devastating to many people, and we mourn for her family. As a way to honor and remember her, we're playing some of the Wisconsin Life stories she produced. In this one, Bree tells us about the passion for historical steamboats in the La Crosse area, just down the river from where she grew up.
My name's Mike. I'm going to be your captain, also going to be your tour guide for the trip here today. So I'll be starting up the tour as soon as we get away from the dock here.
That's Mike Vogel. He's worked on the paddle wheeler, the La Crosse Queen, on and off for more than 30 years. The La Crosse Queen offers narrated boat tours rich in area river history between May and October. She's a replica of the grand river boats that once traveled these waters, minus the steam power. She's white and trimmed with red. A blue awning sits on her top deck to shade sightseers, and at the stern, a bright red split stern wheel propels the boat through the water. Despite growing up in the area, I'd never actually been on a working river boat like this one before. But cruising the plucky paddle wheeler is far from the only way to learn about river history in the area. Vogel pointed me in the direction of UW-La Crosse's Murphy Library. It boasts a huge collection of steamboat and river-related photographs. Paul Beck is a special collections librarian. He estimates there's 40 to 50,000 photographs.
We probably have the largest collection in the country, if not the world, of steamboats and related photographs. Yes. There's only a couple of the libraries that might rival us, and they're also here in the U.S.
Beck says the collection started out with a focus on the Upper Mississippi River area, but has expanded to include other parts of the U.S. and even other countries. But the images aren't just of steamboats. They memorialize river life, from the towns, to the crews, to the passengers. Again, Paul Beck.
There is just something magical about them, and so why not have some photos? And once you get one photo, you can't stop. You can't stop. You know, 40,000 isn't even enough. We want more.
Back on the La Crosse Queen, Vogel's giving lessons in area river history. He says during the peak riverboat years, La Crosse had up to 200 boats a month pass through her ports.
That made it one of the busiest on the Mississippi River.
The tour's almost at an end, and we're approaching the La Crosse Queen's home, Riverside Park. Besides serving as the location of various festivals and a museum with, of course, artifacts from a sunken steamboat, Riverside Park has a surprise. I learned about it from George Italiano. He's with the La Crosse County Historical Society.
We built our Riverside Park in the early 1900s. I think 1909 is when it opened up. But underneath that is actually three steamboats and a barge. So
really?
We talked history on them as well, yes.
I've been to Riverside Park countless
right.
times. There are boats and a barge under that.
Yes.
Wow. La Crosse also continues to be a stopping point for some of the grand river boats, like the Queen of the Mississippi or the American Queen. Italiano loves it when those boats dock.
And it's so nice to see the big steamboats come in because it gives us a reminder of the past.
Community members here work hard to keep the proud river history of this port city alive. When I look at the love the La Crosse area has for steamboats and for the river, it's not just about nostalgia. It's about a passion for history that seems to grow and grow.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Disembark at this time. Thank you again.
That was Brianne Chasso bringing us the story of riverboats in the La Crosse area. Bree formerly worked at WPR and tragically died from cancer earlier this month. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, northern Wisconsin got an early taste of winter this week. The first significant snowstorm of the season dropped several inches over the area yesterday. Looks like there could be more coming up for the weekend. If you're in the southern half of the state, make sure you've got your umbrella handy. Don't put it away quite yet. What's going on in the atmosphere? What kind of weather can we expect for the rest of fall and winter? Chad Franzen is a meteorologist at WSAW-TV in Wausau. Chad, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Rob. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Well, did northern Wisconsin get stick-to-the-ground snow that's still there, enough to stay on the ground overnight?
Yeah, depends on where you're at. So if you're looking at central Wisconsin, if you go from Marathon County northward, that's where we had snowfall and accumulation, and it's starting to melt already today. The heaviest of which would happen all pretty much in northwestern Wisconsin and west central Wisconsin. Eau Claire hit a one-day record yesterday of 6.9 inches all before midnight. A good portion of the Minneapolis area, 6 to 7 across the suburbs. Duluth had close to 6, and Rhinelander had 6 as well as Eagle River. So those areas got hit pretty hard. The rain snow line was a very sharp cutoff, and that seemed to really happen near Stevens Point, Wisconsin Rapids, and over towards Shawano. So very sharp cutoff, and with temperatures already in the 30s today, things will continue to melt from here on out for the rest of the afternoon.
I've gotten snow on me on Halloween in the past, I know, even further south than that. So it's not that weird, but a half a foot in some places in mid-October, is that a little unusual?
It is. I thought we would set a few more records, but conveniently some of our locations that got snowfall had some of the records that were hit back in the early 90s. So some of these locations ended up a couple inches short or just tying a couple records. But it is something that happens, especially as you get into this year, this season, as you're making that transition from daytime highs in northern Wisconsin around 50 degrees and nighttime lows in the 20s. So these storm systems that come up, very similar to what we had yesterday, thick clouds don't allow for heating, and so daytime temps were in the upper 30s, and it turned over to snow pretty quickly, and that's why we got a pretty dynamic storm to dump several inches, especially west central Wisconsin.
Now, it looks like there could be some stuff for our neighbors in Minnesota tomorrow. What's heading that way?
Yeah, another storm system on the way tomorrow. This one's going to go farther northwest out of Wisconsin as far as the snow goes. So Wisconsin tomorrow morning may get a little freezing drizzle in central Wisconsin, and then it becomes a rain event and even thunderstorms. Even far southwestern Wisconsin near Prairie du Chien could even get a couple stronger storms in the afternoon. Meanwhile, the heavy snow threat sets up in the Arrowhead of Minnesota back toward Brainerd, an area that just got dumped on yesterday. In some locations near Brainerd and Grand Rapids in Minnesota could get close to 10 inches by the time that thing ends going into Friday.
You mentioned the rain-snow line, and I know, you know, for the area well north of that line, you know they're going to get snow. Well south of it, they're going to get rain. How hard is it to predict precisely for communities that are right along that line?
I used to have a full head of hair, and then after the forecast this week, I'm pretty much losing it all. This time of year especially, because we still have about 11 hours of daylight, when you get into the winter time and you're only 7.5 to 8 hours of daylight, you know that things don't really warm up very well. It takes a long time to get things really warm. The issue we had is there was such a surge in warmer weather coming up with this, and not just at the surface of the earth, but also in the upper atmosphere, that knowing where that rain-snow line was to start and where it was going to migrate northward to was a real pain to really work with. So initially it looked like it would be an all snow event as far south as Wausau. We ended up getting the rain, sleet, and snow ending as rain after 3 inches of snow, and it's pretty much melted today. The heavy snow line set up right across about the northern half of Lincoln and Langley counties, and that's where you go from 3 to 6 inches real quick. And at this time of year, predicting a warm-up in temperatures going into the midnight hour is very unusual and very hard. Computer modeling struggles to come up with things like that going into climatological seasons that are changing.
Now, we've got this early snow. I know, like with the investment people, they say, you know, past performance is not an indication of future performance. Is early snow, Chad, an indication of lots of snow through a winter?
Not necessarily. Now, we do know that we're going into a La Nina pattern. This is where you have the unusual cooling of ocean water temperatures going off the western part of, not necessarily our country, but the southern equator, going west out of South America. And so what that ends up doing is that is going to induce the jet stream to ride a little farther north and get us into a little more of some, a lot of moisture-laden storms possibly going into the upcoming winter season. But on average, we're right now just entering into moderate La Nina. And so on average, in the last 14 weak to moderate La Ninas, out of this time, and we would expect this due to more storm systems, more clouds, of the last 14 we've had, 11 of 14 had below average temperatures across Wisconsin. And when it comes to precipitation, here's the thing that sometimes happens but doesn't always happen. A lot of times La Ninas come in with cooler than normal temperatures, and then we get more precipitation. Notice I didn't say snowfall, more precipitation into the winter season. Out of the last 14, though, only about half, 8 of them, have had above normal precipitation for the winter season. So that one's kind of a flip of the coin. The thing that we'll watch the most is where the active storm track sets up here in the next 2 to 4 weeks. This happened several years ago in Madison, Milwaukee, where you got pummeled with a lot of snowfall, and the active storm track, due to a heavy, thick snowpack, ends up sitting right there. So what ended up happening was the northern two-thirds of Wisconsin had a cold and very little snowfall kind of season. Madison, Milwaukee set record snowfalls for the season, and that was during the La Nina season. So we'll watch and see where that active storm track sets up within about the next month or so, and then you'll have a better idea if we're going to end up with more or less precipitation for the upcoming winter.
Chad, thanks again for joining us.
Anytime, Rob.
Chad Franzen is a meteorologist at WSAW-TV in Wausau. We talked to them about yesterday's snowstorm in northern Wisconsin and the outlook for Wisconsin's winter. Coming up, we take a look back and recap 4 years of President Donald Trump's administration through the lens of his most noteworthy tweets. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, meet two candidates running for a seat in the U.S. Senate. One's looking to reset Republican fortunes in Virginia. The other's a former mayor with his own presidential ambitions. It's coming up today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a president's favorite way of communicating with the country can have a lasting impact. Franklin Roosevelt had fireside chats via the radio. John F. Kennedy engaged the public through news conferences on the TV. And now Donald Trump has redefined how Twitter factors into a presidency. Our guest has taken a look back at the president's term through the lens of those tweets. We examine which tweets were the most newsworthy, the most surprising, and those that had the most impact in 280 characters or less. Travis Andrews is a features writer for The Washington Post. He covers the internet and culture. Travis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, the tweets from the president are kind of a daily part of the news cycle now. What made you want to take this wider lens look at the last 4 years?
You know, the way that he's used Twitter is so unprecedented for the presidency, and so much of what has happened in reality and in the news, you know, we either first saw in tweets or was, you know, later kind of summed up in tweets. And so it seemed like, since he likes to communicate with the people through Twitter, it seemed like a great place to kind of look back and try to see what we can learn about this presidency from the way he likes to communicate.
And one confusing thing, I think, early on for the media, the public, for Wall Street and elsewhere was, does a Donald Trump tweet equal official White House policy? How hard has that been to sort out?
That was particularly difficult to sort out, particularly at first. You know, we thought and President Trump had said that maybe he would stop using his Twitter account the same way when he became president. That obviously was not the case. And he would do things and has done things like announce policy decisions on Twitter. And we had to decide, is this an actual statement from the White House or not? And, you know, Sean Spicer at the time had said these are official statements. And so we were supposed to take them that way. But as we'll see when we look through some of these, that hasn't always been the case. In fact, sometimes a tweet that he's put out has been later used against him in court when trying to implement certain policies. So, you know, to this day, it remains a little bit of a confusing question.
Well, one of those examples that you give in your piece was the transgender military ban. Can you talk about the tweet and the policy?
Absolutely. So that came in July 2017. Trump announced via Twitter that he was going to not accept or allow, quote unquote, transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. The problem was the Joint Chiefs didn't seem to know about this policy. In fact, many people in his own administration didn't seem to know about this policy because it wasn't an official policy yet. And that's where things got tricky. Some of the experts I spoke to said, you know, one thing he might have been doing is by just announcing it, he kind of ends any internal conversation they were having, and he then makes the military catch up to him and where he is. The problem is that later on in court, some of the things that he had previously tweeted were then used against him in kind of helping stop this ban.
And I mentioned the stock market, and you cite one tweet from the president before he actually was president in the transition period, mentioning a company by name and affecting their performance on the stock market drastically, at least in the short run.
Absolutely. I think that was one of the first moments that we saw how powerful this account could be. So in January, early January, I believe it was the 3rd, he tweeted that General Motors, quote unquote, is sending Mexican-made model of Chevy Cruze to U.S. car dealers tax-free across border, make in USA or pay big border tax. And immediately, Google searches for GM, they shot up about 200%, and the company's stock value declined by 24 cents, a 0.07% drop, thanks to those 26 words. And that was so immediate that I think that was one of the first times we had an inkling that this Twitter account might actually have real world power. And as we now know, has a lot of real world power.
Have we seen that stabilize, though? Has the stock market gotten used to the president venting about a company and maybe not reacting so quickly to those statements?
To a degree, absolutely. It is stabilized a little bit, but they've affected global markets so often that JP Morgan actually created an index measuring the probability that his tweets moved the bond market, and they called it the, I don't know how to pronounce this, the Vol-Pfeffe index, I suppose is how you would pronounce it.
And that refers to when the president once tweeted a non-word, like any of us might text or something, a non-word. And again, the pronunciation not clear, Kovfefe. But given the president's interest in Twitter, this got, I know, a lot more attention than anybody else typing a random non-word.
Oh, absolutely. At the time, I was working with the night shift of the Washington Post. And so I was on the front lines, so to speak, when that was tweeted. And what was, I think so, I think what people really clung to about that, aside from the fact that detractors, you know, use it to make fun of him, and his supporters used it as kind of a proof that he's, you know, just a normal person like anybody else who hasn't made a typo. What was particularly amazing is that it was up for, you know, 5-6 hours. And that's very unusual for Trump's Twitter. Normally, if he makes a typo, he'll delete it, you know, rewrite the tweet or whatever fairly quickly. But this time it was up all night, which gave it an awful lot of time to circulate around the internet. And to this day, that word, if you could call it a word, has become something of a sensation. You know, Georgia had a ban license plates using it. There have been dozens of applications for the word important to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. There is a bill in the House named after it, along with a racehorse. It's really become a strange cultural phenomenon.
Talking to Travis Andrews from the Washington Post. He wrote a piece looking back at President Trump's use of Twitter in his time in office. President Trump announced former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's replacement on Twitter. Put that tweet in context for us with the timing and when Tillerson himself found out he was being replaced.
Absolutely. So I'll read the tweet out because it's particularly interesting in how it announces sort of his firing. So the tweet said, Mike Pompeo, director of the CIA, will become our new Secretary of State. He will do a fantastic job. Thank you to Rex Tillerson for his service. Dina Haspel will become the new director of the CIA and the first woman so chosen. Congratulations to all. The problem was Rex Tillerson did not know that he was being fired. And obviously, you read a tweet like that. I mean, you can just imagine if someone from your station tweeted something like that, and you're like, wait, thank you for my service. What do you mean? I thought I was
so we all know that day will come. Yeah.
So for 3 hours, Tillerson did not know exactly what was happening. Finally, the president called him, and it really seems like a power move. One thing that we know the president likes to do is kind of display power through insults or through just kind of showing that he has ultimate authority over other people, including people in his own administration. And this was a perfect example. If you can be fired at any moment without so much as a phone call, you know, it really keeps you on your toes. On the other hand, it also probably, you know, lowers morale.
And Travis, I think people across the political spectrum have analyzed President Trump's Twitter tactics in two kind of different ways. One, it's just unfiltered venting of whatever is on top of his mind or whatever he's seeing in the news. Or two, it's a cunning strategy to control the media narrative of the day. Having looked back over time, what do you see as the pros and cons of either argument?
You know, I think like most things, it's probably somewhere in the middle. There are obvious times where it seems like he's reacting to something immediately and just kind of firing from the hip, whatever he's thinking. But there are other times where you can see where it plays into his favor. You know, although, as we said, it was later used against him in court, when he announced the transgender military ban, he sort of decided what was going to happen and everyone else had to catch up with him and kind of put his policy into action to some degree. I think what he does particularly well strategically with his Twitter account is he controls the media narrative. If there's something going on that he doesn't like that's being discussed, he can change it fairly quickly, sometimes with, you know, an offensive tweet or something that he knows is going to kind of get people riled up and suddenly talking about the latest thing he tweeted. And with so much news in today's world, with everything moving so quickly, I think that he's able to change the media narrative and keep it that way. You know, he can tweet upwards of 100 times a day sometimes. That's a lot to keep up with for the American people and for anyone covering the president.
Briefly, Travis, as we wrap up, we hear callers sometimes and other voters saying they like President Trump. They wish he would tweet less. They like him except for the tweets. Is it really possible to separate out this central part of his presidency?
I don't think so. I don't think so because it's just become so much of our daily lives. You know, one thing that I thought was really interesting, I spoke to people on both sides of the aisle. I spoke to both Trump supporters and people who are against Trump for this piece. And every single person I spoke to said he would probably be more popular if he didn't tweet. I think his base eats up his tweets, and, you know, his detractors certainly use them as ammunition against them. But I think anyone in the middle, anyone still, you know, trying to decide, pick a candidate in the upcoming election, I don't think his tweets really earn him any favors.
Travis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Travis Andrews with The Washington Post. He joined us for a look at President Trump's communication on Twitter over the course of his presidential term. Coming up, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll preview tomorrow night's final presidential debate and our look at a few of the week's top stories in national politics. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time.